This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right, quick show of hands here, gang. Who wins with this tax bill, do you think? People or companies? You'll see why I'm asking in a minute. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 15th of November. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Taxes in a bit, healthcare as well. But we begin today with the once and future condition of financial regulation in the American economy. Richard Cordray, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, said today he is leaving at the end of the month. That in and of itself isn't huge news. Rumors had been swirling, as they say. What is worth a moment here, though, with Cordray's departure, is pointing out the degree to which President Trump can now reshape the rules and regulations of our financial sector. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer starts us off.
President Trump has vowed to dismantle the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. So Edwin Groshans of Heights Securities says it's a safe bet the president will replace Richard Cordray with someone who has a much lighter regulatory touch.
Now we've just whipsawed the entire industry from heavy enforcement to potentially laissez-faire.
There are many ways President Trump is reshaping financial regulations. He issues executive orders that set the tone for government regulators. Dennis Kelleher heads the consumer group Better Markets.
And what we've seen is the rulemaking process has come to a grinding halt.
Then there's the Federal Reserve. A number of top positions there are empty, and President Trump has started to fill them, starting with Randall Quarles as the Fed's new vice chairman for supervision. He'll be the Fed's point man on bank regulations. Adam Levitin teaches banking law at Georgetown.
I don't think we're going to see a sea change in bank regulation.
Levitin says President Trump won't control the Fed, and to really reverse bank regulations, you'd need a new law from Congress. And he says whatever President Trump's appointees do across government, the banks will keep following the regulations of the past few years. Levitin says it's just too hard to retool.
Do you plan a business model based on a few years of deregulation? That may not actually be worthwhile in many cases.
Because President Trump may one day be replaced by someone who does want tight regulations. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The tax bill that's a health care bill that's a tax bill that's a health care bill continues to wend its way through the Senate Finance Committee. And there are all kinds of ways we could get down in the weeds on what's in the thing and what's not. But there is a more philosophical development here, too. Tax cuts for individuals in the Senate bill are temporary. Corporate tax cuts are permanent, as Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
Here's the calculation Senate Republicans are making. In order to pass a tax overhaul with a simple majority,
the tax cuts cannot increase deficits after the 10-year budget window.
That's Professor Rebecca Kaiser at Brooklyn Law School. She says letting most of the tax cuts sunset or expire after 2025 solves the problem. Except once people get used to tax cuts, they don't usually want to give them back.
It's likely that Congress will face a lot of pressures to extend them. And so perhaps we're not quite accounting for their costs up front.
There's a recent precedent for this. Tax cuts passed during the George W. Bush administration were supposed to sunset in 2010. That was a big issue in the 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns. Alex Brill served on the Bush administration's Council of Economic Advisers. He says eventually Congress made most of those cuts permanent.
But of course, the top rate that had been brought down to 35% was allowed to go back up to 39.6%. So it's really a provision by provision test.
One that depends on the budget outlook when we get to those sunsets.
And we can really already game out that the presidential campaign of 2024 will have a large segment on tax cuts.
Nicole Kading with the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation says it's a budget strategy both parties use. Make the change now and hope a future Congress doesn't undo their handiwork. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a reminder that stocks go down too, and that that is perfectly normal. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Take a look at the healthcare side of the tax bill that the Senate is working on here for a minute. Specifically, how the heck do you run a company in the healthcare industry right now when Congress is doing whatever it's doing? David Cordani is the CEO of Cigna, one of the biggest health insurance companies in the country. He is also today's conversation from the corner office. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you today.
You've been at Cigna and insurance for a very long time. I wonder, on a scale of 1 to 10, how does the current period rank in terms of tumultuousness?
It's about as complex of an environment as I can recall historically over quite a long period of time. Just about everything is moving in the marketplace right now.
How much does it complicate your job then in doing that, that healthcare in this country has become so politicized?
I think there's two edges to every sword, right? In one way, it engages more people in the conversation because there's a broader public narrative around it. Conversely, at sometimes it's more charged, and they're not helpful if diverse people can't come together and listen. And what we try to do is kind of convene disparate forces around that conversation.
We should say that Cigna is, by and large, not in the Affordable Care Act exchanges. You are, but just a little bit. You're mostly employer-based healthcare plans, right?
We're a global company. In the U.S., our healthcare business is largely commercial employers. We have a meaningful seniors set of programs where we sell direct to seniors on Medicare Advantage. And then today we have, about $1.5 billion or $2 billion within the Affordable Care Act. We've been engaged on the exchanges since day one. We've just been more focused and more deliberate in a limited number of states.
Let me ask you why you're staying, though, because a good part of the argument from those who want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, whether repeal, replace, or just do something, is that the system is broken, it's not working, and there's no business to be had there, and yet you're in it.
Yeah, so there's merit to that statement. Our view was that they would be smaller than was projected. It was going to be a pretty rocky road for the first 3 years, so we went in there eyes wide open. And more of that transpired than not. We think we have a social responsibility to try to actively work to make it work. And third, we found some great bright spots in markets where we have high-performing aligned physician and hospital groups. We're actually starting to deliver a positive result, even where there are design flaws, and there are fundamental design flaws. We've been focused, we've been consistent, but we entered this eyes wide open.
On this idea of you having a social responsibility as a guy running this company, I want to talk about for a minute what you're doing with opioids and the idea that you're going to stop paying for OxyContin prescriptions and your work with pharmaceutical makers. How do you go about addressing a huge social issue in this country?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So I think it was last spring we took a stand on this important topic because we didn't think we're having the right social conversation around the U.S. opioid epidemic. Today, we have over 100,000 healthcare professionals that signed on to a practice pattern pledge to change the dosing rate of opioid pharmaceuticals. We actually entered a pretty innovative contract with a different manufacturer with a non-crushable drug, but they're
is the crushable thing because that's what lets people get addicted and abuse it, right? Or vice versa?
It expands the abuse. Yeah. So crush, then you could actually densify and inject. So it just expands the probability of abuse. There's no business rationale for us to do this as a publicly traded company. It simply was the right thing to do. It wasn't being attended to, and we stepped into it quite aggressively and continue to fuel it today with our actions.
David Cordani, he is the CEO and president of Cigna. David, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
The rest of our talk, including what might happen, he thinks, if Congress were to try to make the individual health insurance markets better, is on our Corner Office podcast. coming up.
He leans forward and he looks at all of us. This is the biggest thing that's ever happened to this company. It's also the biggest secret.
Fracking's secret formula, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 138 points today, about a half percent, closed at 23,271. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ off 31 points, 0.4%, 6706. S&P 500 shed 14 points, about a half percent, 2564. More signs that things are not looking so merry for traditional retailers as we head into the all-important shopping season. Today, it's Target's turn. The company unwrapped its holiday forecast and touted price cuts as well. Investors could not have cared less. Target gave back 9.8% today. Walmart discounted about 1.3% today. Notable downturns in tech as well. Semiconductor company MACOM unplugged 18% after its quarterly revenue failed to meet expectations. IBM down 1.2% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. AT&T's bid for Time Warner, $85 billion is the price tag, has, depending on who you talk to, been held up by antitrust concerns or by politics. President Trump's displeasure with Time Warner's CNN is no secret. And yesterday, in front of Congress, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said he couldn't answer a question about whether the White House had been in touch with the Department of Justice about the deal. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, there could be some real legitimate antitrust issues on the table here.
AT&T has a big wireless network. It owns satellite DirecTV, and it provides internet service. It's a distribution company. Time Warner has the content that gets sent over those pipes. You can see how the two might fit together. But how do you keep the merged companies from becoming too powerful? There's basically two solutions.
One is you tell them to sell stuff off.
Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School. He says this is reportedly what the Justice Department is talking with AT&T about, to make the merged company sell off a chunk so it's less powerful. Option number two?
You have them enter in a consent decree, which is a fancy way of saying they promise not to do a bunch of things like raise the prices.
That's what happened when Comcast wanted to buy NBC Universal. But the DOJ soured on this strategy in recent years, even before Trump took office. According to Jonathan Baker, he's a professor at American University and former chief economist at the FCC.
Yeah, for good reasons. They're hard to enforce, and it's hard to anticipate changing conditions when you're developing them, and they require ongoing supervision.
Potential remedies aside, the politics around this deal are putting the Justice Department in a sticky spot, says Eric Gordon, a professor at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business.
If they don't act strongly, they're going to be accused of being the same pussycats they were with Comcast NBC Universal.
But act too strong, and the DOJ risks being accused of acting on President Trump's behalf. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The internet, for all its wonders, is also a place where not-so-great things happen. Harassment of various degrees, of course. And it turns out there are industries built around that. Julia Angwin over at ProPublica got firsthand experience after writing an article on how extremist websites make money. She got hit up by bots, and then she wrote about that. Julia, it's good to have you on.
It's great to be here.
So give us the skinny on what happened to you.
So basically, I and a couple of my colleagues were targeted with what's known as an email bomb, meaning that somebody signed us up for thousands and thousands of newsletters and online accounts, and our emails were barraged with the confirmation notice that you get every time you sign up for something new, to the point where we couldn't use our email and the organization's email actually crashed.
And they turned off your accounts and everything, right? I mean, you were shut off from the modern world, as it were.
Yes. Okay. It turns out I couldn't communicate with anyone after that.
You decided to fight back. You spent, I think, like $100 and got some ridiculous amount of retweets and bots and all of that. Explain, first of all, how you did it and then why it's so cheap to do this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we were basically trying to explore this world, and we realized that a way to explore the world of bots is on Twitter. So we were able to launch two fake accounts, FauxPublica and FauxPublica RU, which was the Russian language version of FauxPublica. And we got, and for I think about $100, we got about 15,000 retweets for are two different accounts. And I think the real issue here is that the platforms that are used to launch these attacks, they're not the one that suffers when you're attacked. And so their incentive to prevent this type of attack is low. And right. In fact, and oftentimes they get a boost from not preventing people, right? Because if they allow more signups or more Twitter accounts, it looks like they have more users. And so their incentive is to kind of maybe turn a blind eye to it.
Right. And Twitter's response to you all was basically, hey, it violates our terms of service. And that was it.
That was it. Yeah. They just pointed us to their terms of service and said, like, you know, obviously that's against our rules. And I was like, well, yeah, but there's literally firms out there whose whole business is buying and selling Twitter bots. And I don't understand how, you know, that's a viable business if they were really enforcing their terms.
The bigger point of this somewhat serendipitous investigation you all did, and you say this, you actually write, we are collectively losing faith in the promise of the internet. This all comes at an especially vulnerable time for life online.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it seemed like a really good thing, this whole internet. I was definitely really into it, you know, and it was like going to topple, you know, authoritarian regimes, and we were all going to get better airline tickets. And sure, that did happen. But it also is true that the internet being decentralized and unregulated is a wild west and is being used for massive amounts of, you know, what you could call information warfare. And a regular person's ability to defend against this, it's a constant arms race, and we're always going to be losing against the bigger machine.
What if I am a regular person, though, and for some reason I've gotten caught up in this bot? I mean, you are, Julia Angwin, internet professional and savvy user of the interwebs. Not everybody is.
Absolutely. And you hear these stories all the time of people who are like, I quit Twitter because the abuse was too much. I mean, I think this is actually becoming a lot of people's experience with the internet, is that the cost and the harassment is higher than perhaps the benefit. Hmm.
Julia Angwin is a senior reporter at ProPublica. She wrote this piece with Wired about email bots and Twitter bots and how to fight back, I suppose you could say. Julia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We're going to pick up with Scott Tong now and the second of his two stories on fracking, the technology behind the oil and natural gas boom we are having in this country. Technology is not a word often associated with heavy industrial processes like drilling, but that's exactly what fracking was, a technological innovation. And when you innovate like that, the law says you get to keep some of the key details secret, like in fracking, the chemicals that are used to get the oil and gas out of the rocks. Now, though, some EPA documents suggest that that secrecy comes at a cost to human health. Here's Scott.
A huge breakthrough in modern fracking came in 1997, courtesy of a stubborn Texan named George Mitchell. After 17 years of trial and error, he and his team stirred up a secret recipe of water and chemicals and sand, shot it down a well, and lots of natural gas came back up. Mitchell is now dead, but his colleague Kent Bowker remembers cracking the code.
And Mr. Mitchell got this big smile on his face. He leans forward and he looks at all of us. This is huge. This is the biggest thing that's ever happened to this company. It's also the biggest secret. No one can talk about this.
Secrecy is at the heart of invention and capitalism. And with drilling and fracking, the ingredients of special chemicals are allowed to be kept confidential. That starts as soon as the manufacturers apply for government approval. Newly released documents from the EPA show that. I'm flipping through hundreds of agency papers released under the Freedom of Information Act to the environmental group Partnership for Policy Integrity. They show that chemical makers routinely withheld all kinds of info in their applications for government approval from 2003 to 2014. Molecular structure, product names, what they're used for, who makes them. And the system allows this. In fact, the regulators, they have the confidential info.
EPA knows everything about these chemicals, but they cannot make that information public.
Dusty Horwitt is attorney with the Partnership for Policy Integrity. The documents show that the EPA listed health risks about most of the chemicals it approved. For instance, the risk of poisoning to the brain and lungs and liver.
If EPA's own regulators are finding that there are health concerns about these chemicals, and then they allow them to be used commercially in oil and gas wells, the public has a right to know.
He and more than 100 toxicologists and advocates are sending a letter to the EPA today asking it to release the details on more than 40 drilling and fracking chemicals, ones that the agency knows are risky, especially to people living near drill sites. In 2014, in southeastern Ohio, an oil well site caught fire. It engulfed 20 trucks and triggered 30 explosions. Black smoke filled the air above Rebecca Bowen's house.
Our throats by then burnt so bad. They told my daughter her esophagus was melted. My husband, after this happened, he was diagnosed with 6 spots in his lungs.
Thousands of gallons of chemicals escaped into a local creek that dumps into the Ohio River, according to a federal investigation. Bowen drives me there.
Possum Creek. That's where all the fish died. They said there were 77,000 fish or something like that that died. There's still people that's up there swimming. And who knows how them chemicals went into the earth.
The well operator later gave out a partial list of the chemicals used, but some the company deemed proprietary and didn't release. That's allowed by state law. So doctors and scientists treating patients like Rebecca Bowen, they don't always know what they've been exposed to. Now, some chemicals are known, like ethylene glycol, which can affect the kidneys and the lungs. Others are surprises, says David Brown. He's a toxicologist with the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, about an hour east of here.
We've learned that there are chemicals there that we never even expected them to be there. Had we known that, it would have been possible to organize a more systematic approach to protecting and determining the safety of people that are living near the gas drilling.
In a case of potential exposure, he doesn't know what to look for or what to test for.
My alternative has been, think of everything. It's very expensive to ask questions that didn't need to be asked.
For instance, blindly running a host of lab tests. Now, the industry maintains the risk of drilling and fracking pollution is negligible. That's been proven by multiple studies, according to Jack Girard, president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute. Here he is in a speech to his group last year.
Yes, the science should be settled on that, but there are some who aren't content to have the science settled on it because they have agendas and are advocating for their particular position.
Oil and gas groups say that chemicals do get reported to a national database, though with exceptions for trade secrets. And in emergencies, they say, all the chemical secrets are available to doctors and first responders. But in the 2014 Ohio fire, the responders weren't given the info for days, says Silverio Caggiano. He's a battalion chief of the Youngstown Fire Department and part of a regional hazardous material response team. He spoke by cell phone from the firehouse.
Firefighters, you know, we have this tradition of running in where people are running out. And without the knowledge of what's in there, running in may be turning us into victims as well.
Delay means responders don't know how a mystery chemical might behave as it gets out. Will it float on the water or sink or mix in with the water?
I have no way of containing it. I don't know how to contain it. That's why that information is so critical to first responders within the first 30 minutes of us being able to formulate a game plan, because after 30 minutes, game's over. It's going to do what it's going to do.
Caggiano says oil and gas chemical secrecy is unusual. In every other sector, truck drivers with chemicals carry papers listing the contents. They're called medical safety data sheets.
The driver's MSDS sheets, even if he is not alive, I know where his MSDS sheets are. They're within a foot of his right hand. But, you know, with the fracking industry, whatever they're hauling, there's not going to be one.
Caggiano has signed on to the letter asking the EPA for more disclosure on oil and gas chemicals. We reached out to the EPA for comment and received no response. In Southeast Ohio, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a perhaps unintentionally revealing moment from White House economic advisor Gary Cohn. Cohn was being interviewed at a Wall Street Journal CEO conference yesterday, obviously about the tax bill. And at one point, the guy doing the interview turns to the audience, an audience, again, made up mostly of CEOs, and he says this, and then you're going to hear Cohn at the end.
Can I ask you all a quick question? If the tax reform bill goes through, do you plan to increase investment, your company's investment, capital investment? Just a show of hands, the tax reform goes through?
Not a lot of hands go up.
Okay.
Why aren't the other hands up?
Why aren't CEO hands going up when they're asked whether a tax cut is going to make them invest more? I don't know. There's a whole lot of reasons, because business is complicated. But I would be remiss not to mention here that the entire premise of the corporate tax cuts that congressional Republicans and the White House are planning is that in giving companies those cuts, those companies will then spend more, invest more. That money will trickle down, and that wages will rise and workers will benefit. Unless CEOs don't actually decide to invest more. Okay, that's it. The Dow off 138 points today, about a half percent. NASDAQ down 31, 0.4%. S&P 500 dropped 14 points, about a half percent. Again, folks, that's entirely normal. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.